Okay, let's get started. Good to see everyone. So we're continuing our conversation about civilian casualties in Halakha. And excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm nursing a little bit of a cold. And for those of you who were last here last week, for those of you who were here last week, you'll recall that we started off with a really important and fascinating incident of the first great debate in Jewish military ethics when it came to the question of how Jews should respond to terror, the great Arab revolt between 1936 and 1939. And if you recall, one of the things I argued is that, we didn't have classic texts necessarily utilized, and that raised a broader question, as Ben-Gurion himself asked at Jewish agency meetings, can the Rambam, so to speak, tell us what's the right thing to do in this situation? Meaning Ben-Gurion is raising a broader challenge. Is there something which Judaism has to say and can contribute to this conversation? As I think we tried to argue last week, there is something to say, and I try to argue that we have a number of principles. You recall I placed 9 principles on the board, which I felt were true about what Jewish feelings on military ethics, perspectives, elements that go into military ethics. And I want to keep that in the back of our mind as we discuss, I think, what the second great incident in the history of civilian casualties and Jewish military ethics. And this emerges in the 1950s. And once again, the issue is of reprisals. Remember, reprisal is when someone does something to you, give them back a taste of their own medicine. Now, this was clearly the way of the world for many generations, many centuries, and certainly in the 30s, and for that matter, during World War II, this was certainly a way in which wars were fought. But the question always arises is what if the tactics used by the other side are so terribly immoral? Can you respond in kind and do something that so would normally be immoral against them? And so that was part of the debate in the 30s. And unfortunately, that debate sticks around in the 50s. And one could argue that that debate, unfortunately, remains relevant today. And so we are, excuse me. And so we're going to go now to the 50s to discuss the what was known as the reprisal raids against the Fayyadin. The Fayyadin were irregular Arab fighters, meaning it wasn't a formal troops per se, but they were certainly being helped, sponsored, or looked the other way by both the Jordanians coming from the West Bank and from the Egyptians coming from Gaza. Remember, there's no such thing as a Palestinian state, right? There's the Egyptians are controlling Gaza, and the Jordanians are controlling Yehuda Shomron, what's known by then as the West Bank, the Fedayeen. Yes, excuse me. Would I say something different? In any case, whatever it is, but that's the Fedayeen. And so these Fedayeen are having these raids. And keep in mind, there's no clear border, right? There's not like the west of the Green Line is this natural. It's not like there's like a natural, river or mountains or anything like that creating this border. So there's a lot of what you might call hefkerut, right? There's a lot of sort of unclarity about where the border is. I mean, to give you an example, if you ever look at the Green Line on a map, if you ever drive through Israel and want to see where the Green Line is. So I live in Modi'in. When I travel from Modi'in to 443, which is like the major highway right off of Modi'in, I cross the Green Line like 4 times. Right, just sort of you wave through it back and forth, so it's a regular street. Right, it's one of these things that Modi'in properly is on the non, means on the it's on the side of Israel that was given to Israel even after the armistice, right? That was with the Israel armistice. But one part of Modi'in called Maccabim is actually on the other side of the Green Line, meaning there's no like you would never know that, right? There's no way of knowing that per se, and so. This is a massive problem for security. And because of the vulnerability, the Fedayeen are really able to attack almost at will against Jewish civilians. And they also raid property and whatnot. And it's really causing a tremendous amount of insecurity for Israelis. And one of the low marks of this was a terrorist attack on a place called Yehud, in which a mother and a child were killed. And it really sort of shook the young Zionist state. This is in October of 1953. And it killed a 32-year-old mother and two of her children, excuse me. One is a 4-year-old, one is an 18-month-year-old. And so Israel decided after that it had to go on the offensive. And it forms a special commando unit led by a recently retired or sort of out of service veteran of the War of Independence named Ariel Sharon. And Moshe Dayan, then the defense minister, brings in, excuse me, chief of staff, brings in Ariel Sharon and says, listen, we need to go on the offensive. Part of the problem is that we're being just responsive to the attacks of the Fedayeen, and we're not going on the offensive. And so they lead the commando unit, which is meant to attack, and primarily does, meant to attack the Home Guard or others that are seen to be as part of this Fedayeen. However, an infamous incident in the village called Kibia, okay, the Ariel Sharon's unit enters, and there's a bit of a dispute still amongst historians, and Sharon has gave different versions of it over time. But it's clear that they believe that from the city of Kibia, many of these Fedayeen raiders were coming from. And the goal was to attack and kill and deter these raiders. The end result of that night, and I think it's fair to say that the orders certainly were not to create this, but the end result of that night was about 70 people were killed, including many women and children, majority of women and children. And this caused a really great stir in, of course, in international circles, but even with Israeli society itself. Okay? International circles, they have what to complain about here, but since they haven't been doing too much about the Fedayeen, many people in Israel are like, well, why is it when we kill, Israelis kill, you care? But when the Fedayeen kill Israelis, you don't really care. Okay, but that's an old issue. But beyond that, right, there is this outrage in Israel over what had happened. And David Ben-Gurion did what David Ben-Gurion occasionally knew how to do when it was necessary, and that is he lied. And he said that the IDF was not responsible for this, but it was rather sort of a group of unruly, Jewish villagers who couldn't take it anymore and had attacked this Arab village of Kibia. Now this was a outright lie, and he knew it. But Ben-Gurion knew I'd occasionally do this, for better or for worse. And without commenting on that for now, but privately, everyone knew, and certainly in the cabinet knew that that was not the case. And what I want to now share with you are some of the responses within sort of the intellectual community and the rabbinic community to this raid. Okay, because what really emerges at this time isn't only a matter of ethics and what Jewish ethics say, but also emerges is, do Jews have to behave differently than others? Do we hold ourselves to higher moral standards? Which might just be what we think is morality. But when the other side doesn't play by any rules, do we have to play by the rules anyway? Because that's what our moral imperative is. And we started to discuss this to a certain extent last time, but you'll recall last time one of the big factors was perhaps this is a supreme emergency. Perhaps, which of course was true, though we didn't realize how true it was in the late 30s, perhaps the ends justify the means. Now, you could make such an argument in this case as well, but here you have an army now. You have a proper army. You're not just dealing with, sort of underground groups. And what really, it's not what you call a supreme emergency. It's not that the clouds of war are hanging over Europe, but there's certainly an insecurity in the state of Israel, a feeling that it's by no means guaranteed that this young state is going to stay around and alive. And so, one of the debates that comes up is, well, given the fact that the people that we're fighting against just randomly kill our women and children, how badly do we have to feel about what happened? Okay, so as I did last time, I want to show you sources which are not classic rabbinic sources, although we will see now we're going to start getting into some really classic rabbinic writings. But I want to show you some interesting sources that emerged. And this, once again, is now not from a Jewish agency meeting, but is from a Israeli Knesset meeting. Okay. And in the Israeli Knesset meeting, they more or less know this wasn't, random fighters, right? This wasn't random. They know this is army soldiers or special unit. That at some point they know this. And in it, there's a leader of the Mizrahi political movement named a man named Chaim Moshe Shapira, very interesting figure. And Shapira had been against the raids of the Etzel in the late 30s, right? He supported the Havlagah, purity of arms, right? The restraint in the late 30s. And this is what he had to say in the cabinet meeting. He said, listen, throughout the years, we were always against this, not just today. Even when there are murders of Jews in the land of Israel, which was quite common before the founding of the state of Israel, we knew how many were killed week after week, month after month. Yet we have never said, let the innocent be swept away with the guilty. Whom, of course, is he quoting here? Bereishit, Perek, Yud Chet, Avraham Avinu, right? And so Chaim Moshe Shapira brings the story of Avraham Avinu at Sodom and says, God doesn't let the innocent be swept away with the guilty, neither should we. Okay, and you understand we saw a bit of this type of sentiment last week as well. And but as I mentioned to you last time, I don't know what happened today in our cabinet meetings, but excuse me, but at the time, the cabinet meeting members were certainly well knowledgeable about Tanakh and the Jewish history. And so Chaim Moshe Shapira makes this statement, and the health minister, Yosef Serlin, goes and says, we wouldn't have done this. What do we do in the times of Yehoshua? Right? Didn't we have any problems with that when we wiped out 31 Canaanite cities? So you, Chaim Moshe Shapira, right? What are you talking about? To which then Moshe Sharet, right? Remember him from last week, then SureTalk, now Moshe Sharet, foreign minister, future prime minister, of course, goes and says, what are you talking about? Right? Are we living in the times of Yehoshua? Right? In other words, what is he saying? He's saying, like, why is this relevant here? And interestingly enough, Ben Gurion chimes, oh, sorry, Shapiro responds back and says, listen, in the times of Yehoshua, we also had the story of Achan. Remember the story of Achan, where Achan takes some illicit booty and the Jews, Israelites lose the war and they go and they find him and they kill him and his family. And he's like, listen, you want to invoke Yehoshua? We're really going to invoke Yehoshua? And David Ben Gurion, who was actually a big fan of Tanakh, not much of a fan of Talmud or Halacha, but a big fan of Tanakh, and especially of Sefer Yehoshua, goes and says in the cabinet meeting, everyone stop quoting your psukim. We all know we could quote psukim to support each side here. Really fascinating moment, and we saw this last time as well. Ben Gurion, who loved Tanakh, understood that there are different strands of thought, or different strands of thought could utilize Tanakh to support themselves in this. Okay, so once again, the question isn't just what our morality should be, but in this cabinet meeting was also about does Judaism have a moral teaching on this topic? Okay. Now I want to show you some of the fascinating responses that took place at the time. And we're going to start with Zalman Shoragai, who later becomes actually, for a short time, is a very prominent religious Zionist thinker, short time actually mayor of Yerushalayim. And he writes quite an interesting treatise on this issue, where you might say coming from the right. And he calls it Ben Dam Ladam, between blood to blood. And he says as follows, Lo Nitayim Nomar, for sure, let's all agree. She'ein ish b'yishuv shelo yizdazea ad omek nafsho b'kol shvichat damim she'i. We all are horrified by any form of murder. Ein adam Yisrael shelo yizdazea b'muna al adam she'eshvach v'kibya. There's no one in Israel who isn't saddened by the bloodshed in Kibya. Or yoter nachol, better yet, al adam shehuchrachu l'shvach v'kibya. Or rather, better said, he says, is that we are saddened by the blood that was forced to have been spilt in Kibya. And who forced them to spill it? V'im kara ma shekra, hari adam shenishvach tofelo l'shem shel elem midot arav omdim al gabam. Says, who's responsible for what happened here? It's the Arab states and their leaders, who not only have not stopped the Fedayeen, but have also seen this as a way of a political means of attacking the Jewish people. And so he says, listen, they're the ones who have caused this threat. They hold responsibility for the fact that over 400 people have been killed since the armistice. And if 400 Jews have been killed, you're going to ask me to cry about 40 plus, you know, women and children. Why? It's their fault. Okay? And then he goes and says, listen, I know all these, you know, people are saying, oh, it's terrible. How could Jews do this? And so he starts and says, Aim dat tam shivitzuchim ole shevichu buk yadayim, right? We have to respond somehow. What's your plan to stopping this? Right? Remember this from last time as well. Right? He goes back to this. He says, what is your suggestion on how to stop things? And he goes and says, listen, who says that their blood is redder than our blood? So the premise, of course, is that this is going to work. And then he goes and say, people say it's disproportionate, right? And friends, nothing has changed, right? And I'm not comparing one another, but the terms, you understand, right? So it says, they say it's Tonim negra proportio, lami kabubimu, what's the proper proportion? In other words, what he goes on to say is, listen, this was a necessary response because we have no other means. And then he goes as a long tirade against the UN and says they do nothing when they attack us, right? And then goes on to say and attacks them more and more on it. And then basically goes on to say at the end, listen, if they want this to stop, they could stop all of their economic wars and physical wars against us and respect the armistice and create a proper Chatimat Shalom, peace agreement, and that would solve it. In other words, what Shragai is basically saying is, listen, I'm not saying this was ideal, what these people did. I'm not saying who did it right now, but he's saying that this was a type of response which is acceptable in the world. Everyone who's criticizing us for this reprisal raid is a bunch of hypocrites. We'll see how hypocritical they are momentarily. And that's, you know, what is necessary. And you want to scream about these Arabs, you know, tragically dying? Why aren't you screaming when all the Jews are being killed? Now, let's think for a moment. This is 1953. What military events, of course, are still very fresh in everyone's minds? World War II, and particularly the end of World War II, such as dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which could be argued, and was argued certainly at the time, that this was necessary to stop the war, and was also a form of a reprisal against what had been done to the Allies. And so part of what the response here is to say, you know, all of a sudden now you get all self-righteous. But this is the way of the world. This is what's going to stop things. And therefore, this is justified, or certainly should not be condemned. Okay? That is response number one, or two, I guess, depending on how you think about it. Okay? But this is sort of saying, this is what is necessary. Now, and interestingly enough, a young chemist, up and rising thinker, named Yeshayahu Leibovitz, who later becomes very well known for many of his more controversial statements, but already now is becoming a prominent thinker, and he releases a very fascinating and influential essay called Acharei Kibya, After Kibya. Okay, and you can see it. It's in Hebrew. It's in English. You can search it online. I will try to, if I can figure out how to do this in the middle of things, send as well a link to it. It's a worthwhile essay to read, short essay to read. And Leibovitz starts off and says, listen, there are all these self-righteous Jews who are criticizing us and other people in the world, but he's particularly angry at the Jews. And he says, listen, you know, it's so easy for you to criticize us when you don't have the responsibility for defending the community. Meaning, you're sitting there in New York and London, Los Angeles, Toronto, South Africa, wherever it is, right? And you're, oh, I can't believe, I'm so embarrassed, this goes against Jewish values, right? Well, it's really easy for you to say that because you don't have responsibility for the fact that over 400 Israelis have been killed over the last few years. And then you go and say, oh, we never did this. This is against the ways of the Jewish people, right? This is against what we did for many centuries. So look what he says about that. He says, listen, you're just, thinking that that because you never had any power. You're congratulating yourselves that we have gotten rid of the impulse to communal murder. And he says, the reason why that was is because we had no such disposal for self-dispense or for the attainment of collective aspirations. So all of these self-righteous saints, right, should really learn a little bit of modesty. A very interesting statement in its own right from Leibovitz. And then, and he goes on to say here, only the decision of one who's capable of acting and on whom rests the responsibility for acting or refraining from action can pass the genuine test of morality. In other words, what he is saying here is, listen, those of us who have responsibility for this are going to have to decide whether this is right or wrong. It's really easy to be the morning, a Monday morning quarterback, or to from afar criticize, right? But, you know, just like, be quiet. Okay? Very, very powerful statement from the get-go. And then he goes on and says, okay, but listen, we need to think this through, right? We haven't had this issue for many centuries in our exile. We should think about this, right? How it is that we'd want to, now that we have the possibility of the craft of Esau, as he calls it, okay? And he says as follows, we can indeed justify the action of Kibya before the world, right? They say you've adopted the method of reprisal. And he says, well, we could argue that we have not behaved different than did the Americans with a tacit agreement of the British in deploying the atomic bomb. In other words, you could also, by the way, mention Dresden, right? There are many other examples of this in which you can invoke reprisals and say, you know, you did this after 6 years of war, World War II. We now have 6 years of war in Eretz Israel. In the land, in the state of Israel, we have a constant fear of plunder and murder. And therefore, he says, it is therefore possible to justify this action, but let us not try to do so. Let us rather recognize its distressing nature. And he says, listen, we could have justified and said, this is like the story of Shechem and Dinah. But what does Yaakov Avinu tell us at the end? This was wrong. They acted inappropriately. And therefore, what Leibovitz says is, listen, this is not the way we want to go. Now, it's not exactly clear why that is. But part of his argument is to say that the only right way of acting in this case is through restraint. And he warns, and in this way, in some ways, he sort of presages some of his later critique of Israel, particularly of the settler movement. But he warns and says, if you say that everything is holy and is done, l'shem kedushah, l'shem mitzvah, then man is capable of acting without any restraint. In other words, what Leibovitz is really worried about here, and says, you could justify this. If you justify this, you're going to justify this in the name of God, in the name of holiness. And you know what ended up happening? You're going to create holy wars that remove all restraints. Don't go there. Okay? Really, really interesting essay in some ways, because on the one hand, he's saying, this is the way of the world. We just did this a few years ago to end the war against the Germans and the Japanese. There, you know, what are you causing a big tumult here? You could justify it. It says, but don't do it. Don't do this. Let's recognize the fact that this is wrong. He doesn't exactly tell us why. And I think more than anything, what he's really afraid of, Leibovitz, is once you start making these types of arguments, you're going to lend yourself and lead down the path to real types of immoral and destructive behavior. Fascinating argument, right? Which, of course, by the way, later on in his life, he's very, very critical of many things that Israel does. But already here in the 50s, he's saying you could justify it, but don't. And here we get to, you know, an interesting question, which is, let's think once again, what does Judaism have to say about this issue? So Leibovitz has an interesting answer. He says it's irrelevant. Because what I care about is morality, and morality is not something which is subject to an adjective. Very interesting statement. Okay, what does he mean by that? We have Jewish ethics and Christian ethics and, you know, Buddhist ethics and Muslim ethics and secular ethics. He says all that's nonsense. If it's ethics, it's universal. And therefore, you might have some universal ideas from Jewish sources or Christian sources, whatever it might be, but it's either compelling or it's not compelling. If it's compelling, it's binding to everyone. And if it's not compelling, it's binding to no one. Okay, very another fascinating statement of his, which more or less says that Jews need to hold up to the principles of morality. Not greater necessarily, but not less than others, because this is what should be universal, and that's what ethics is all about. And I think that part of his other fear, besides of this is going to lead to a holy war, is that when you start to justify behavior in your own terms, in the terms of your own people and your own tradition, you have no form of check or balance against this. And so Leibovitz is basically saying you're going to sort of self-justify for yourself what you do based on your own terms. That's not ethics. It will ultimately lead to terrible behavior. Okay? Very fascinating. And then we get to what I think is actually probably the most famous rabbinic essay on Jewish military ethics, and in some ways sets the tone for many, many centuries of a certain strand of thought, certainly religious Zionist world, about military ethics. So let's take a step back for a moment. I would say, and we'll see, talk about this more next week as well, but I would say that there are sort of three general strands of thought in rabbinic writing about Jewish military ethics. Strand number one is taken by Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook. He was not so prominent in the early 50s yet. It's not one of the major figures. I mean, he's a figure. He's definitely a figure. But his prominence certainly emerges much more in the following decade. But he's still a figure for sure at the time. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook has no writings about Jewish military ethics, but how we should behave within war. And his one of the editors, chief editors of many of his writings, Rabbi Shlomo Aviner, a very, very prominent posek. Rabbi Abiner has written and said Rav Tzvi would have felt that Basically, whatever is necessary to win is allowed because this is our country and homeland. This is our property, and therefore we're allowed to do whatever is necessary. Now, and therefore he didn't write so much about Jewish military ethics because the only real question you have to ask yourself is, can you win? And if you can win, then what's necessary to be done can be done. Doesn't mean he likes bloodshed, wants to kill people, et cetera, right? Doesn't mean that. It just means that when push comes to shove, that is acceptable. That is allowed. Okay? And I call this, I refer to this not as an immoral position. It might lead to immoral behavior, but an amoral position because it's really removing, this relates back to the point that Leibniz made. It is removing us from the realm of thinking about Jewish ethics, right? And just basically saying we have a divine entitlement to this country, the same way, by the way, that many nations around the world believe they have a divine or some other right to their country on their own terms, on their own land. So too, Rabbi Yehuda says we have entitlement to our land. And it's amoral because there's nothing you can argue about that. I mean, you can't have a conversation back and forth on that. The same way, by the way, you couldn't respond to, let's say, a Christian claim, a crusader claim saying they have entitlements to the Holy Land, or Islamic claim saying they have entitlements to certain land. At the end of the day, it's an amoral claim, not immoral, but amoral claim. It's just not something you can have some form of argumentation about. Okay? So that's one view. There's a second view, which we can develop more next week, which I started developing also the previous week, which says, no, we can develop some form of Jewish military ethic, and we can develop certain principles. And I'll argue, as we'll see next week, that that's a position taken by Rav Shlomo Gorin. And then there's a third opinion, which really emerges in the 50s, right now, precisely at this moment with regard to Kibbeh. And this opinion is taken by the head of the dean of the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva, or become the dean of the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva, Rabbi Shaul Israeli. Okay? Very, very prominent figure, also a member of the Beis Din, the great Beis Din HaGadol of the Rabbanut Rashit later on. And Rabbi Israeli writes very, very influential essay in the wake of Kibbeh. We're talking about 54 now, and he's writing this, in which he starts to look deep at the sources, classic sources in Judaism, and asks a very simple question. Are there actual sources for ethics, military ethics in Judaism? And so he starts quoting this war and that war, and are there limitations? Remember, the big question is always going to be, are there limitations? That's sort of what is, and particularly in the what sort of the defining key part is, are there limitations when it comes to who can be targeted, taking with regard to civilians and non-combatants. And so he goes back and forth into different stories and he says, what about Midian? Remember the war against Midian? Does that prove something? He says, no, that doesn't prove anything. It was a unique type of war of Nekama. We're not going to have any form of proof from there. And he talks about different events and different models, a RODEF model, people are coming chasing after us. Is that applicable? Is that not applicable? And you might say, listen, the people in Kibbeh are RODEF, right? They were coming to chase after us. But of course, that's a very hard argument to make because, first of all, not everyone in Kibbeh was, certainly the women and children at the time weren't. And B, you never know, right? If, let's say, even they were housing the Fedayeen fighters, would you think of them? Maybe they didn't do it, willfully. Maybe it's against their will. So how do you know for sure that they are actually actively participating in it? And so he goes back and forth from a number of different sources. And in the end, he makes a very, really fascinating type of argument. Let me pull it up here. And he invokes here the law of what's known as Dina de Malchuta Dina. Right now, we all know that Jewish law requires us to keep the laws of the land, as long as they're legitimate laws, right? pay taxes and whatnot. And the principle that governs this is known as dina de mahuta dina. The law of the land is the law. And that applies within the borders of a country. Well, Rabbi Yisrael is a big chiddush, very novel idea, in which he says that dina de mahuta dina doesn't only apply within a country, but it also applies between countries. Nearly she social dina de mahuta echadu. V'gam ben am la'am hu rak nitzar haskama. If there is agreement between the nations, if there's conventions, if there are treaties, right, in which the nations agree upon certain rules, this is binding, right? Ki hare gam b'amrei haskam b'nei m'na'im p'usho shekol ha'cha v'chad iskim l'zeh. It says, I don't mean, of course, that every single nation has said it. I want to say that the vast majority, right, are agreeing to this. So in other words, there's a rove here. And you can say that there is such a thing as a haskamat klalit in the world. The nations of the world have accepted this idea that war is a legitimate way to solve political conflicts. V'rak b'doratenu amalim, shamlachama tukar kibilti chukit. It says, now it's true, there are a lot of efforts in our time period to try to say war should not be used in this manner. Of course, he's referring to Genocide Convention and various other treaties, human rights treaties, and 1949 Geneva Conventions, and other phenomenon, ve'adayin lo ichshar dara, but the nation, the generation is not yet ready for that. Ve'ina muchanem likanes b'tchavut hadadit ve'in zeh, and there's no genuine reciprocal obligation to ban war. Meaning, what does Rav Yisrael say? The premise, why is war allowed? Because the nations of the world have decided that war is a legitimate means. And if the nations of the world would not only agree, but in practice implement that war is illegitimate, we would say wars are usher. But as long as that's not the case, yesh lirot haskamat amim shemilchma hi echadam simuchukim. Ko od shamim nilchamim shomim al noag hamekubal ba'amim beyachas lemilchama. Right? He says, right, that this is one of the proper methods of determining political differences. That's been accepted, and as long as people practice this, that is the case. In other words, what Rabbi Israeli says is that Judaism has a requirement to keep the rules based on what the nations of the world have agreed upon and practice. Okay? He makes that point here at the very end. It's important to emphasize that. Because sometimes people say, what if there's a rule that everyone agrees to but no one actually keeps? You could argue that about many military rules, meaning, I don't want to get too political here, but someone asked me recently, well, if the Hague, you know, if the International Court of Justice finds Israel's, you know, probable of committing genocide, is that a problem, according to Halacha? It's such a ridiculous claim from the first place, but beyond the fact that when you have the Syrians and the Russians and the Chinese judging us, do me a favor, right? So it's hard to know, as Rabbi Israel is well aware of that. But his point is that there's generally practice, right? Well, we wouldn't do it. So you have to ask yourself, well, do the nations of the world allow for reprisal attacks, which include the purposeful killing of women and children? That's a complex question, particularly in the 50s. Okay, so it's very interesting what he has to say about this. And here I think is a fascinating answer. And he goes and says as follows, I have this in translation, where he says, what emerges from this discussion, it's a long treatise, but this is what comes out at the end of it. What emerges from this discussion is that even in our day, a military operation by the people of Israel under the rubric of discretionary war is halakhically possible. In a war, there's no need to be meticulous and differentiate between righteous and wicked because the nature of war does not make it possible to be meticulous. Moreover, war conducted in this way is for as long as the conduct in war is accepted amongst the nations. Now, he's not saying, by the way, And he assumes this to be the case, that we purposely targeted women and children, as we'll see. What he's saying is that you don't have to worry, though, when you're going after the combatants about distinguishing between the righteous and wicked, because A, it's not possible, and B, the nature of warfare acceptable in the world doesn't demand this. And therefore, with regard to the matter under discussion, one must examine if a military response of this kind is supported and accepted among the nations. Because if it's accepted, won't have to view it as something agreed upon, etc. And therefore, there will be no shfichut dami. Okay, so what Rabbi Israel is saying is go look around the world if reprisal raids are allowed. And we accept with equanimity that many non-combatants are going to be killed as well. So too here. And he goes on to say there's room for military operations of retaliation and revenge. That's reprisals, right? An operation of this kind is in a mandatory war. And whatever disaster and harm is inflicted on the enemy perpetrators of violence, their associates, and their children, it is their very own responsibility and they will bear the sin. And there's no obligation to avoid military reprisal operations because of the concern that innocent will be harmed. For as now we are the cause, but they themselves, the enemy, we are guiltless. Okay, so what Rabbi Israeli is saying is that if the ways of the world accept the idea of reprisals, they started this. They attack our women and children. We can attack them back in the same way that is acceptable responses in the world. Now, this is a very interesting argument because on the one hand, what's he saying? Play by the rules. Judaism demands that we play by the rules. Whatever those rules are, that's what we play by when it comes to war. And you could say, oh, wow, okay, this is a big deal because we don't have many sources of placing restraint. Could argue, as we saw last week, but okay, irrelevant. As those are the rules of the game that accept in the world, that's what we'll do. But of course, what might conclusion you might come to if you say that, take that position? If the rules of the game, at least the way they're practiced, is that in a reprisal, you can go and just kill all sorts of people. Women, children, etc., what might you end up have happening? Judaism, Jews, in the name of Judaism, in the name of the Bible, in the name of the Siskama, will go and just kill children. Because, hey, that's acceptable practice in reality in the world. Are we comfortable with this idea of Judaism allowing that? And Rabbi Israeli, at the very end of the essay, says no. However, regarding the intention to harm children from the outset, this is something we have not found in the Jewish tradition except for Irmi Dachat. Therefore, one should take care not to harm them. Meaning, the whole time he's pushing this idea of conventions, conventions, conventions. At the very end, he says, yeah. But of course, I don't mean you're allowed to attack children. That we don't find in the Jewish tradition. And of course, you might respond and say, Midian, Canaan, Amalek, what are you talking about that we don't find killing children in the Jewish tradition? But Israeli has his answers for that, and he basically says, despite whatever conventions and practice are, we would never do such a thing like that. I think it's a fascinating essay. And by the way, a couple of his primary students have argued and say that what Rabbi Israeli has really argued here is that he just feels that we don't have to worry about collateral damage, but we should only be targeting combatants. Meaning, he's not just saying not to target children. He feels that we should really just be targeting combatants. Now, he does say very explicitly there, he has no problem of killing the men in Kibia, but it's also clear that he's assuming that the men are actively fighting. And they're actively fighters there. Whatever Rabbi Israeli's intentions here, this is a fascinating essay because on the one hand, he's saying, play by the rules. On the other hand, he's saying, if the rules aren't sufficiently moral, don't forget, we don't go and purposely attack children. And the truth is that Rabbi Israeli's model is a model of conventionalism that other philosophers adopt in later years. And they say, listen, all these moral distinctions between combatants and non-combatants, this or that, you can break them down. But at the end of the day, we have a real benefit to building certain military conventions, stick to those conventions. And the problem always comes is if the basis for the way we behave in warfare is simply on conventions, what do you do about the problem of reciprocity? Because how does a contract work? How does a treaty work? How does a convention work? The premise is that everyone is following it as soon as one side breaks the agreement, what can the other side do? Break the agreement as well. Is that really our vision for what Judaism wants from us in war? And you see Rav Yisraeli at the very end here struggles with this factor as well. And therefore, Rav Yisraeli ends this and says, with regard to the children, we should not be aiming for them. And you can see throughout, he's really saying you don't have to be too careful about collateral damage. And that's why I think his students actually write that what he's really trying to say is attack only those who are attacking us. Whatever his intention, you understand the problem. And so I think that this is a really fascinating, right? We'll go back to the question we started with, which is, do Jews have to behave differently than others? What was the answer of Shuragai? What are you talking about? The whole world has reprisals. The whole world doesn't say a thing about them killing us. And now some people went and killed people in Kibbeh, and now you're going to say, what's his response? No, right? We don't have any obligation to act differently than others do. You saw Chaim Moshe Shapira outraged and saying this goes against morality of Avraham Avinu, right? Trying to quote that. We saw Leibovitz, who says we could find sources within our own tradition to justify this, but don't go there. Don't go there because of what it might lead to, and don't go there because you can't build morality based on that. And then we saw a really fascinating answer of Israeli, which says Jews just have to play by the rules, whatever those rules are. We don't have to play by higher standards when it comes to war. But then at the very end saying, well, I'm a little bit nervous about that. Okay. And what I think ultimately that emerges in my mind, and then I'll start going to the chat and the questions from this conversation is, if you just rely on conventions, you're going to get yourself in a very difficult situation. But if you think you can just fight war based on your morality and ignore the reality of the way others are fighting, you're going to have a really hard time of fighting as well. And so I think one of the dilemmas that emerges from here is on the one hand, it's uncomfortable for us not to have our own ethic, to have an ethic, and to believe in ethics of how we should behave. At the same time, there's a understanding that there's a problem if we don't have reciprocity and people aren't keeping the rules, right? Do we have a releasing of some of the limits of warfare? And what I hope, please God, to show you next week is to develop the theory of Rav Gorin, who I think was the most comprehensive in many ways of the rabbinic theorists of military ethics, in which Rav Gorin tries to explain and lay out what he thinks is not a convention, but a matter of ethics, what Jews, how we should behave in the midst of war. Okay, but it's a fascinating incident. Let me take a look at a couple of the questions here. Yaakov seems concerned that his camp is fewer in number, not that Shimon and Levi weren't justified. The parak ends with Shimon Levi asking, "Hachzonah yaseh achotenu?" They seem to be getting the last word. So, Judy, this is an excellent question, and you're absolutely right that in the original story, Yaakov is saying, "You're endangering us. Everyone's gonna come after us." And Shimon and Levi are basically saying, "Right? Well, we're not. We can't stand for this." And by the way, in Perek Lamed Hey, what are we told? The nations surrounding the Jewish people were fearful of them. And so you could say from Perek Lamed Hey that maybe the message actually is Shimon and Levi are okay. But the last word actually in the story comes many prakim later in Perek Lamed Tet on Yaakov's deathbed when Yaakov is highly critical, and this is what Leibowitz says, and we'll see Reb Goren says this as well, where he says, forgetting about the pragmatic problems of what you did, Shimon Levi, what you did was act in a behavior of Hamas, right? Not the terrorist group today, that's sort of an irony of that word, right? But rather of saying, are you acting in the way of Hamas? This is not acceptable. So I do think that Yaakov does get that. I think Nancy writes this as well, right? That clearly doesn't approve of that type of behavior. Susanna writes, you heard a Dvar Torah recently that Shimon Levi did was a hostage rescue. So there is a theory of the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. Or HaChaim, I mean, yes, obviously part of what they want to do is get Dina out. But the Or HaChaim actually has a very interesting theory where he says the goal of Shimon Levi was simply to kill Shechem and Hamor. It was just to kill the people who do it. But what ends up happening? When they go after the leaders of the city, what ends up happening? The members of the city come to defend and they end up having a full out battle. And so that wasn't their intent, but that got started up. So yeah, you could make such an argument like that. It doesn't seem like that to me because they have this whole plot beforehand and they do the bris, right? And you know, all these other things. So, it's not, it doesn't clear to me about that, but that is such a theory out there. Ben Ben Melech asks, well, women are soldiers and some also use child soldiers. How can they be exempt? Ben, I totally agree with you. The Rabbi Israeli and Leibowitz and others are talking about a time period where women and children are, so the women weren't soldiers. And so the premise is these are people that are not combatants. But, you know, in our times when you have plenty of women who are soldiers, right? This whole notion of, you know, women and children are exempt is like so chauvinistic and antiquated. I don't know how else to say it, right? In other words, the fact that like we release these women, you know, terrorists in order to get the women hostages out, as if like that's not a big deal. Like these are like bad people who did terrible things and could kill just the way we've had female suicide bombers, that seen female terrorists, you know. I totally agree with you. When it comes to children soldiers, and that's a tragic phenomenon, children soldiers, but absolutely, listen, end of the day, if, you know, I read about an example in my book where there's an Australian ethicist who's describing how in Iraq, there's an Australian sniper that saw a kid, like a 13-year-old, pick up an RPG and was aiming it at the back of an Australian army truck. And the sniper had to decide, do I shoot or do I not shoot? Because it looked like he was going to shoot his comrades. And the sniper decides not to shoot. And in the end, the army truck goes off and nothing happens. The kid didn't shoot. The kid didn't pull the trigger for whatever reason. No, we don't know why. And the ethicist starts talking about, you know, well, they did the right thing. He didn't want to kill the child, whatever. I mean, he goes back and forth on it. And I'm thinking to myself, I think that was totally, I don't want to say totally wrong, but it would have been a totally legitimate judgment call for the sniper to say, that child at that moment is a clear and present danger to my comrades. I'm going to shoot him. So, you know, I agree with you. And that's part of the argument to say that what Israeli really cares about is not the distinction between women and children as opposed to men. It's between combatants and non-combatants. And whether that's what he says, I totally think that's true, right? That's true. That's really be the critical distinction here. Another question comes up here is, wouldn't anyone who isn't an armed threat be innocent that we should target? Why does Yishmael? Okay, yes, exactly, Daniel. Yeah, that was exactly. Great, I agree. It's not a matter of, you know, gender. And therefore, you know, you have men who aren't combatants, of course, and women who are combatants, and then won't be along these lines. There is another factor which seems to coming up here in one of the questions we want to discuss, which is as follows. Does this work? Does killing the random non-combatant actually serve as the deterrent? Okay, because in practice, Israel did do a prize raise. Again, most of the time, and during this time period, aimed at members of the Fedayeen. And the question became, did the reprisal attacks work? And I think that it's fair to say that they didn't. Meaning there may have been a short reprieve on the Jordanian side, certainly not in Gaza. And there's actually a really fascinating essay by a military historian named Yagil Henkin. Yagil Henkin, of course, is the Henkin. Right? He's the child of Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, Zatzal, and Melech Haim Aruchim, Rabbanit Henkin, and his brother, Eitam Henkin, was, of course, killed in a murder attack along with his wife a few years ago. And Yagil Henkin is a military historian, and a few weeks ago, before October 7th, where there's still talk about various behaviors, West Bank, whatnot, and someone there had a whole debate about whether Jews can take, you know, the law into their own hands. And Yagil Henkin wrote correctly, citing many others before him, that attacking noncombatants does not work. It's not a good deterrent. And the reason for that, like these types of terror things, and the reason is think about how we respond when these things happen. It makes us mad and angry. It makes us build up our fortitude. And so it's not really clear that this works. And we saw this last week as well, where Shertok says in 39 to the Etzel, you guys have been killing Arabs for the last 3 years. You killed over 250. Hasn't helped. So that, of course, is a big question as well, right? Is this actually a form of deterrence or not? We've been having this conversation in terms of that assumption would be true. The question is whether or not it is true. And the last question I want to address, and then we'll pick up next week. Ethics are an armchair exercise. No one thinks about what is or not ethical on the battlefield. I think it's totally false, meaning that is empirically false. You can see this from many, many different reports. Sometimes people don't have the opportunity to think in those manners. They have to make a gut instinct, of course, and that, of course, is true. But strategically, it's set up in order to behave ethically. And I think that there are many that try to behave ethically in the course of war, a battlefield. This is it. Now, just because you mean you shoot doesn't mean that you're not behaving ethically. Many times you may have to shoot. Many times you don't know for sure and you have to shoot because you have to protect yourselves. That is also ethical. I don't think it's true that ethics are an armchair exercise at all. And that, please God, we'll see next week when we get to the discussion between Rav Goren and Rav Yisraeli in the great debate over the Siege of Beirut in 1982. Okay. Good time as always with all of you, and I look forward to continuing next week. Be well.